We are recording.
Hi, this is Taylor Stevens, the New York Times bestselling and award-winning author of the kick-ass Vinicle.
That is the intro for this week's show.
You want me to do it again?
Yes, please.
Hi, this is Taylor Stevens, the New York Times bestselling and award-winning author of the kick-ass Vanessa Michael Monroe thrillers, and this is the Taylor Stevens Show with my good friend Steve Campbell, where we are kicking writing in the butt one word at a time.
So, Taylor, before we get to today's question, which is a listener question, the question is about effective ways of dealing with the passage of time in stories. It's a great question, and it's actually a call-in question, so I'm super excited about that.
Yes.
But before we get to that, you posted on Facebook that you got a cat a couple of months ago. I'm curious, how's it going? Do you still have the cat?
That kitten has clawed her way into our hearts and lives. She's getting bigger now. I think she's about 4.5 months old. And actually, funny you should ask, when we first got her, she's so tiny. I think she shouldn't have even left her mom yet. She was just so tiny. And she would hide in these places around the house that, you know, like in between cushions and stuff. So I had to find a way to get a bell on her. But she was so tiny that little collars wouldn't fit. And I found this harness that I had used when my very small dog was a puppy. And I mean, the dog had grown out of it like in a couple of weeks. But if I got it on its tiniest, tiniest settings, I could get this harness on the cat. And I found a bell and I tied it onto the back of the harness. And so we could figure out where she was all the time. Well, she's growing and that harness has reached its max expansion. And I'm looking at her thinking, no, we need to get this off of her. But she's already chewed off the bell and I've got to go find her a collar with a bell on it. Well, lucky me, kitty cat collars all come with bells. Yay. So I get a collar with a bell and I get it to this because I got one for a cat, not a kitten, and I get it on its smallest setting and I bring it home and I take off the harness and I put the little address tag and all the things that she needs on this collar and I stick it around her neck. And as soon as that thing is on her, she takes off like a bat out of hell, like something's trying to kill her. And she's literally doing parkour, running up the walls, bouncing off, just like, what demon has come after this cat? So we finally get her, and her heart is beating so hard, and she's just breathing like crazy. So we take the collar off, and we realize something on this collar has terrified the poor cat. And I don't know if it was that we just didn't give her enough time to adjust to it, and I just assumed, hey, she's used to having a bell on her. Maybe this bell is a different kind of sound. I don't know what it was, but I just knew that this kitten now is terrified of this collar. And I'm thinking, well, crap, this is her collar. I can't just go take it back to the store. So I'm going to see if I can figure out how to get the cat to wear this collar. So every night before I go to bed, I'd go get my bag of kitty treats. That's how I taught her to come when I call her, is with the kitty treats. I'm like, okay, she loves these treats, right? So I sit down with this collar and the cat and the treats. And if I even so much as touched her paw with that collar, she would just split. She was gone because she was scared of it. But gradually, over time, night after night, working with her with the treats, a little bit longer. And so yesterday she wore the collar for the first time.
Well, congratulations.
That was my cat training story of the things you do for little kitty cats who've clawed their way into your hearts.
And how big is the little kitty? Because I remember you posted a picture on Facebook and the kitty was like the size of a thumb.
She could fit into my hand. She was so tiny. She's not cat size. She's about half the size of a full-grown average cat. I'll see if I can get a picture of her and we can put it side by side up.
Okay, now that would be fun. All right, Taylor, this is our very first call-in question. If listeners remember, we were begging people to call in with questions a few months ago or a few weeks ago, and we set up a Google Voice number, and we finally got a question, and this is it.
Hi, Taylor. Hi, Steve. This is Jill, and I would like to ask about the various ways to deal with the passage of time in a scene so it won't seem contrived. For example, many times I've read in a scene where characters sit down to a meal And then the next sentence starts with, well, now that dinner is over, let's talk. I mean, who does that? Who waits till the, you know, end of a whole entire meal to get out what they're really, what they really want to know? Or car rides were mentioned in previous podcasts, and nothing ever happens in a car ride, but you need your characters to get from place A to place B, and you're not going to have them fly. So how do you get that time passage of, say, 6 hours when they're driving, when there's not really much to add to the story? So my question is really an effective way to deal with time management in your story when what, when ways in which a character would normally go about their daily activities won't fit into the storyline. Thank you.
Jill, thank you so much for calling in with that question. You can't, I buzzed Steve as soon as I got the call, and I was bouncing up and down in my chair going, we got a call to our phone number. Have you seen it? Have you seen it? And he's like, calm down.
But yes, thank you, Jill. Thank you for doing it. And now I think we should officially rename the phone number to the Taylor Stevens Show hotline.
Yes. Because we have finally gotten a call to this hotline.
So it is hot now.
excellent questions. And there's a few different aspects to this question. So I'm going to just kind of break it down a little bit. And so the first part of it, where you ask about where characters will sit down to a meal, and then the next sentence starts with, well, now that dinner's over, let's talk. Okay, that type of scenario should never happen in fiction. And here's why. Because as you said, who does that in real life? Exactly. Who does that in real life? But not only that, is like we talked about and like you referenced on previous show, you know, being in a car, nothing happens, it's boring. Well, the same thing happens whenever somebody's sitting down to a meal or whatever. It's boring. That is a perfect opportunity to actually have the conversation, especially because one of the difficulties in doing dialogue is having those beats of movement in between that allow something to be taking place while we're talking that keep it interesting, because movement is what keeps things interesting. So when you're actually at a table and you have all these props that your characters can play with, why waste those? That's a perfect time to have a conversation if they're going to be having a sit-down conversation. But this whole thing of, and now that we've had our meal, let's talk, no. That should never happen. And if that has happened where they're traveling in a car to get somewhere and they only talk after they get out of the car, that is just, someone's not thinking. Then they're not utilizing the tools at their disposal for this storytelling, and it's poor storytelling. And I apologize. I don't mean to criticize anybody. If you saw it in a real book, I, you know, whatever. I'm sorry. So that's the first aspect of it, is that you, during these beats of boringness, it is a time to take advantage of conversations, and that's what I did when writing The Doll. Is when we had those long stretches in the car, that's where some of the character development came out, through conversations, through actions, through the conflict and stuff developed inside that very tight, compressed space. And that is probably the best way to take care of a forced car ride, for example. The other thing is, you don't have to show the boring stuff if it's not critical to the story. So in your question, you talk about, you know, characters sitting down to a meal, and then after the meal is over, okay, let's talk. But in many stories, it's not even necessary to show the meal. It can be where characters are coming together to talk. And if you're in a story where characters are gathering for the meal, it should be part of the plot, part of the character development. Are they coming for a Thanksgiving dinner? Then that is actually, you're going to use that aspect of the meal as a way to bring out who these different players are, who the characters are, etc. So when you're skipping time in a story, that's, I think it's called, I call it a transition. I think that's what others call it too. I don't know.
I think
and you're
right.
Transitioning from one thing to the next. And those are difficult for me. What it used to be difficult was you felt like you had to tell everything that happened along the way. And that's sort of a rookie mistake. It's a mistake I made a lot, and then I'd have to go out and edit it all out. And it's because when you're writing this story, you're kind of trying to show how life happens. But in storytelling, you're allowed to remove all of that. I mean, the classic case of removing those huge time sequences is when the fairy tales end at the end and it's happily ever after, and there's still a whole life that goes on after that that we never hear about. And you can do the same thing in the middle of each story. So, you know, you take Cinderella, for example, since we're talking about fairy tales, and you know that she's cleaning and cooking and doing all of these things for her stepmother, but we don't then see her do every single one throughout the day. We see brief flashes of it, and we get the point. So it's the same thing when you're writing novels. If your character is at point A and you need to get them to point B without telling everything that happens in between, the easiest way to do it is with a scene cut, where scene A ends, whatever is going on ends, and you either chapter break or you scene cut, which is it's that space in between where you're aware that there's a break in time, and you start over with a fresh scene inside the same chapter. And you can do that multiple times with multiple scene cuts in a chapter if you want to cut out time. Another way that it can be done is to say when they arrived, or any variant of that, in the house, or it depends, it's going to seriously depend on what took place before and what needs to take place after. But it's perfectly acceptable to just cut out huge chunks of time. 6 hours later, he was in the foyer of whatever, you know.
Yeah, just as quickly as possible to ground the reader in the new setting, whatever the new setting is.
Yeah.
And the new time. Yeah.
The next day, she stood on the sidewalk outside ABC building. So you can completely cut the going to bed, the taking the shower, the getting up and getting coffee, all those boring little things that we don't need to know about. Don't even put them in the book. Just they're gone. And when you do put them in, they need to actually matter to the story. So I hope that kind of answers the question. The punchline of the question is, what's a really effective way to deal with time management? And to me, the most effective ways are scene cut, scene change, and, you know, the next day, 6 hours later or whatever, and just skip all the rest of it.
Well, let's talk about meals for a little bit, because you're so right, because that is a great way. There are so many things, so many great things you can do with meals. In terms of character action and going over information, I was reflecting back on the Spencer books, and I've talked about the Spencer books before. Robert P. Parker's character, Spencer, is a private investigator, and he has a longtime girlfriend named Susan Silverman. And in every Spencer book, there are a half dozen meals between Spencer and Susan. And there are two purposes to those. One is to show their relationship, but the primary purpose is to catch the reader up on everything that Spencer has learned in the last five chapters so that we don't lose track of all the potential clues and everything that's happened.
So is he doing it like as a discussion with her,
yes,
laying out what it is that
She'll want to know. She'll ask a question, you know, what happened with this bad guy that was trying to kill you? And then Spencer, instead of saying, well, he didn't, let's have another bottle of wine, he reflects back on everything that's happened since they'd last talked about it.
Which, honestly, is really convenient. And it's nice that he has somebody to hash that out with, because when you have a character who doesn't have that, you've got to find a way for them to hash it out for the reader in a way that doesn't just sound like regurgitation. So, yes, I agree. If you've got the ability to use meals in that way, use them.
And then you used the term movement beats, which I thought was perfect. And I think that's one of the things that make meals so good, because then you don't have to scratch your head or scratch your elbow or, you know, all the things that we do as little movement beats. It's, you know, in the case of Susan, you know, she took a minuscule sip of her martini as Spencer ordered his fourth beer of the night.
Right. And what, just as a side note to that, what that does right there is that's also showing the character's frame of mind. It shows, you can show emotion, and it makes it so, because, you know, one of those rookie mistakes is, you know, she asked quietly, you know, or, you know, suddenly, or, you know, one of those. And when you can show through those movement beats in that passage of time, the tight lips, the small sip of wine, the reservedness, or whatever the case may be, you have a way to showcase your character. That is characterization right there.
Do you have favorite movement beats?
Well, according to my readers, I do.
Well, what do your readers say are your favorite movement beats?
Well, you know, it was one of those things that I learned the hard way by having people call me out on it, that it never crossed my mind before. But in The Informationist, I did it a lot, where somebody would lean their elbows onto their knees, like they're sitting on the ground, and they would, you know, rest their elbows on their knees, leaning up against something. And I think I must have used it 4 or 5 times, but apparently it was a unique enough movement that one would have been enough. Hmm. And it was pointed out a few times. So I got the point. So I'm very careful now about movement beats to try and eliminate using the same thing more than once or twice, unless it's a like a character tick or something. In that case, then I will use it to bring out characterization.
How do you decide how to use them? Say there's a lengthy conversation, a conversation that takes a page, a full page. How many movement beats would you throw in?
Well, you know, it's an interesting question, because we could spend a whole show or two on dialogue, which is what we just moved into. So the short answer to that question is, it really depends on the scene. The long answer to it is, let's do a show on this. It'll be fun.
Okay. Yep. As soon as you said that, I started writing it down, and I put the number 2 next to it, because I love it when we have a series.
So now that we know we can talk about that in another show, I want to come back to the issue of passage of time.
Okay.
Which was where we started off. Because another thing that I've seen, and I actually just saw this in a book that I was reading recently, is where a lot of things happen in between something big happening. And we essentially get a montage in writing by the author saying, you know, then fall came and she did this, and through the fall, this, 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 and this, and this happened, and this, that, and that, and that. And then she learned this. And it's all really brief things that would be really good for the reader to know, but it comes so quickly and without any vividness that it turns into something of a telling rather than a showing. Now, I am not one of those people who rides that tell don't show, that show don't tell horse, because it sometimes in fictions it is necessary to just tell it and get it over with. The question is, where do you tell it? And while a montage works very, very well on screen with the music and the fast, rapid cuts, it doesn't work on the page. It is effective in getting across the information, but it's boring because it's just blah, 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 blah. There are probably many solutions to eliminating montage out of the written word. My solution, not the best, but mine, is to simply somewhat recap it in the middle of a scene and tie it together to the middle of action. So in the case of where all those things happened, and then the fall passed, and then the this, obviously that's going to be a story that has a huge gap in time. And in this case, this particular book, it did. It had many jumps around in time, which worked very well for the story. So since that was the format that the book was written in, under those circumstances, it wouldn't be a problem to the next time we saw that character and she's discovering something or having a fright or there's some form of tension, tie in the past in even briefer brush strokes so that the reader knows what happened. And then you skip the montage, but the information is still there.
How many bits of information can you give in this greatly condensed version?
It depends on how in-depth you're willing to go into each one. I try to, when I'm doing it, try to keep it limited to a single time frame or a single emotional response. So if we're dealing with something that made a person angry, for example, then you can do many beats that follow that same emotion. Because like the time he did this, 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 and this, or in the summer when that happened, and then he did it again in the winter with X, Y, Z, and it's still the same anger that's running through each one, you can get a whole stream of them in there. Mm-hmm. But if it's a bunch of different non-related interconnected things, then it's a little trickier, and you're going to want to find ways to insert them where it doesn't slow down the action of the moment. I guess the point that I'm trying to make in both of these answers, the one about the most effective way to deal with time management that Jill called in with, thank you, Jill, and also the issue of the montage, is that you don't want to be boring. And if you can find a way to fit something in such a way that it is not boring, then you can break a lot of rules. You can break the montage rule. You can break the, you know, eat and then let's go talk after rule. You can do whatever you want if it's not boring and if it makes sense, if it's not contrived. So ultimately, in all of these questions, in all of the issues that we touch on, that's really what we're trying to get at, is how do you not be boring? How do you keep your readers reading? How do you keep them turning the pages? And when it comes to the passage of time, it's either by eliminating that time so that it's not shown on the page, or by finding a way to slipstream it in such a way that it becomes natural flow in the character's thoughts and actions and reflections.
Well, Jill, thank you so much for calling the Taylor Stevens Show hotline. And I hope that we have another question soon, and there's not a lengthy passage of time between now and the next time we can welcome a listener to the show asking their own question. That this has been a lot of fun. It was a great question, and it was fun to just kick around different ways of looking at it. So, Jill, thank you again so much for doing that.
Yes, and if you didn't feel that your questions was sufficiently answered, feel free to ask it again in a different way, and maybe I'll understand it better next time.
And as our call to action, and I'm going to toss this to you, Taylor, it should be obvious today.
Call to action. This is me being literal and put on the spot. Call our phone number?
Call our number, our hotline number, which is 469-587-9367. And now you know exactly what'll happen. You call and leave a message, we play the message, and then we respond to the question. So you get to be on the show with us, which is a wonderful thing.
And you know what? If you can't come up with a question, just leave this voicemail saying how awesome we are, and I guarantee we'll put that on the show too.
That will definitely be on there. We might actually start using it as our new intro.
That would be so cool.
Thanks for listening, everyone.
All right, guys. Be with you next week.